Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, it's one of my favorite kind of shows. This is a show where Chris and I get to talk about what's making news in the broadcast engineering world and how that news might affect you and me as broadcast engineers, and Chris too. That's all coming up on This Week in Radio Tech.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, saving, and support, online at bgs.cc. By the new Ruby console from Lavo. See Lavo in your future at lavo.com/twart. And by the Telos Alliance, shaping the future of audio, inspiring you to create the most exciting and engaging audio experiences imaginable. Visit telosalliance.com/opt-in.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. It's the weekly show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. And we have a lot of things to talk about in between, a lot of headlines. It's going to be a headline show. So this week, we have no third-party guest. This week, it's Kirk Harnack, me, I'm your host, and Chris Tobin, who is my co-host and has been since day one. And we'll be talking about some of the issues in the headlines and giving our thoughts on some of those. And so there you go. We always like to hear from you. I know we're not the easiest people to reach, but you can check us out on our Facebook page. There's TWRT, This Week in Radio Tech. That's a Facebook page, so just look that up. If you just type in This Week in Radio Tech or TWRT, you should find it pretty easily. We also have a website, thisweekinradiotech.com. And you can reach us there. You can, there's a way to submit an email or, you know, a message through that site. That's easy to do. Honestly, it's a little bit tough for us to take live messages during the show with a chat room there. So that's tough to do. And, that's why we don't do it. We don't have a big staff. It's pretty much me and Chris and our producer, who is Suncast, but he's just busy keeping the audio levels, right and doing the video switching. So we'd love to hear from you. If you have questions or topic ideas, that would be just great. And of course, we got some great shows coming up. In the near future. I won't let you in on those just yet, but we got some good ones coming up. All right, today's show, Ripped from the Headlines, is a show where we're going to talk about, again, what's in today's news, and we've got a few interesting things. Well, let's go ahead and bring in our co-host, Chris Tobin. He's standing by at a studio somewhere, probably around New York City. Chris, welcome in.
Well, thank you, Kirk. Yes, I'm in a studio. I'm here in New Jersey in one of our production facilities, and I'll be doing two things. So we'll be doing TWRT, and we'll also be doing a two-way with NPR and one of their guests here in Newark. So they're automatic. They'll be in the background. I don't have to worry about it. As long as I just keep an eye on the ISDN code.
Actually, this is a good way to start the show on a technical note. When you say you're doing a two-way with an NPR guest, so you've got somebody who's going to be interviewed, and they're located in New Jersey. They're not at NPR's headquarters. They're not convenient to go into the Washington, D.C. Office of NPR and studios. So how does this work when they come into your studio?
Well, the way it works, we do this quite often, and I just have to be corrected. I just realized, looking at the calendar, this person is actually with a public radio station in California who is an NPR affiliate. So we did NPR this morning. I got my calendar dates upside down. But either way, it's still the same mechanism, workflow. So basically a two-way for a radio station for us, or network operations, is the radio station is the link between two endpoints. In this case, it's KCRW in Sacramento, I think it is, California, mm-hmm. and us. And they happen to have a guest for a talk show that they have, a weekly or a daily show. The guest can't make it out to California that conveniently. The transporter still doesn't work yet. And so they come to us. We provide the link for a nominal fee. They use our studio, and they connect bidirectionally with ISDN and do the interview as if the person's sitting in the studio with them. It's very simple. We did it with the NPR folks this morning. We did it with the BBC 2 days ago, and it's a lot of fun.
And so they're going to record both ends of this interview at KCRW, right? Oh, I'm sorry. They're recording at your end.
No. We in this particular setup, we're not doing any recording. We're just providing the means. We're providing the highway, the freeway, access to the freeway.
Gotcha.
That's it.
The guest is in your place.
They're on the road.
I guess it's your place. The show's at KCRW. They're recording both ends of it down there. Okay. I remember that there was a time when we didn't have ISDN, before ISDN or before it was very popular, and now we have IP codecs, which can do basically the same thing. But we used to have a situation where there was, let's say, a senator, a congressman, someone at the Department of Energy that NPR wanted to interview, and they would send a courier out to their office with a cassette recorder. And then NPR would do a phone interview with that person, but they would be recorded locally at their office with a cassette recorder off to the side. And then that courier would bring the cassette recorder back to NPR's studios, where they would basically splice their local tape and the cassette tape together to make a high quality interview. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's tape sync. That's a tape sync. Yes, actually, that kind of stuff is still done today.
Really?
Yeah, it's still done today. Okay. Yeah, we actually did it a couple of months ago. We got a call for somebody. Could you? We're going to interview the person by phone. Can you record the responses? And we're like, yeah, sure, no problem. We do tape syncs. We do it all the time. Quite popular. Wow. It's convenient.
Tell you what, we've got headlines to discuss, including some interesting topics like the FCC is going to take more action on EAS and WEA. That's the wireless emergency thing. iHeart has put a new person in charge of podcast programming, and I only bring that up on a tech podcast like ours to point out that this is getting really popular. And I think we know it, but a lot more broadcasters are doing this. One of our sponsors, Lavo, has appointed a new head of sales in the Americas. How will that change anything? That's pretty interesting. Always good to see our sponsors doing well. The World Broadcasting Union has called for C-band protection. We'll be talking about that. And also, the Alabama Broadcasters Association is hosting a free seminar for the Alternative Broadcast Inspection Program. So if you've ever been interested in being an alternative broadcast inspector, stations pay for that, and you can get paid for it, too. So there's a seminar coming up that's going to address that. All that and more is coming up. Right now, we're going to hear from my friends at the Telos Alliance. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Martin Deister, Vice President of Business Development and Product Director for Telos Infinity IP Intercom System. Telos Infinity is different to any other intercom system because it's the first IP intercom system that doesn't have a matrix. Great communication within the broadcast environment is essential to TV and radio production. With Telos Infinity, you can link all your production crew, whether it's the director in the production control room, sound guy in the booth, boom operator on the floor, your anchors in the studio, presenters out in the field, weatherman, even your weatherman. Production staff listening to communications audio are hearing crystal clear sounds. It means the nuances of the people communicating with them can be heard all the time. Everything is crystal clear and accurate. The master intercom panels that we've created include multicolor LCD switches. You can use color coding to group IFBs, to group production crew members, your remotes, anybody else. Matrix-free intercom means low cost of entry, low cost of design, low cost of installation from the get-go. With Telos Infinity, you start saving money the moment you install it, and you continue to save money for the life of the product. The same benefits that broadcasters all around the world have found by using audio over IP now apply to intercom for the very first time. Never before have you been able to communicate using program quality audio simply by connecting two devices into a network switch. It truly is plug and play. Programming an intercom system has never been easier than it is with Telos Infinity. With our advanced dashboard programming utility, you can have your intercom system out of the box and up and running in record time. I'm Martin Deister, inviting you to visit telosalliance.com to learn more about Telos Infinity Broadcast Optimized Intercom System, the first matrix-free IP intercom system optimized for broadcast.
And remember, intercom isn't just for television stations. It's also good for a lot of radio stations. And I know that the Telos Alliance has a installation going on right now. I can't tell you where, but they're installing an intercom system at a radio station right now. And it's pretty cool. If you're a radio engineer, a radio broadcaster, and you thought we can't afford an intercom system, even though that would help speed communication between studios and newsrooms and things like that, well, maybe you can afford one now, especially if you already have an audio over IP network. Doesn't really matter which one it is. We'd rather, the folks at Telos would rather it be a Telos-based Axia system. But check it out, the Telos Infinity. Go to telosalliance.com. All right, Chris Tobin and Kirk Harnack here for This Week in Radio Tech. Let's jump right into the headlines. And Chris, the first one here, the FCC to take more action on EAS and WEA. They're going to propose some changes at its July 12th open meeting. The EAS and WEA are up for discussion at the July 12th meeting as part of the ongoing efforts to revamp the nation's emergency alert system. The FCC is considering two documents, a report and order, as well as a further notice of proposed rulemaking. Okay, a lot of blah, blah, blah there. The report and order proposes several changes, including adopting requirements for performing live code tests, which are those local EAS tests that use actual EAS alert codes to train communities how to respond to actual alerts. And within the last 2 months, the commission has issued several waivers of its WEA and EAS rules to both mobile providers and public safety officials who are looking to test the viability of EAS and WEA alerts in their local areas. As part of the order, the FCC plans to reiterate that these tests must explicitly state that the event is a test, not an actual emergency. So, Chris, it kind of just sounds like some housekeeping going on here and making sure that these things are more easily testable without scaring the public. Do you have any other thoughts on that?
No, that's true. I mean, the problem with a lot of these tests, emergency tests, whether it be from local office of emergency managements and other things, is that a lot of times people forget to mention it's a test and continue to say this is only a test or drill during the time that they're talking or the events taking place. But, you know, with EAS and WEA, the hardest part is always going to be who has the control of access to the control point. You know, who accesses it? Is it the local jurisdiction, law enforcement? Is it state? Is it a county? You know, it's interesting to see where that goes, because I can tell you from looking at my EAS receiver box, I get all kinds of alerts that pass through that come across, and I say to myself, okay, if I'm a station that's not paying attention, I could easily be putting stuff on the radio that's probably not where it should be. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see how things roll out, where people pay attention or not. Because I've traveled, where was it? Sullivan County, New York State. I was one weekend driving through the countryside, and the station I was listening to was coming across state lines from Pennsylvania, and apparently their EAS automatically overrides program. And the National Weather Service came across with its thunderstorm warnings and things that were taking place, so the weather was changing. And it just totally interrupted, went into it. It was, interestingly enough, I knew what was happening, but if I was somebody who didn't know it, I think I would have panicked to some respect, because it just comes right in the traditional way of saying this isn't blah, blah, blah.
Good. Are y'all good there? Okay. Yeah. And one thing that I find interesting, or that is notable in the proposal here, is they're going to help prevent false alerts by requiring that EAS participants configure their EAS equipment to reject CAP protocol-based alerts that contain an invalid digital signature, and legacy over-the-air-based alerts whose expiration time falls outside of specific time limits. I thought they were already doing that. The related further notice of proposal we're making is seeking comment on several areas. Here are the areas they're looking for comment on. So if you're a broadcaster, an engineer, you may want to. Whether there is a need for false alert and lockout reporting, and how such reporting could best be implemented. Whether the EAS rules should be revised to require state EAS plans to include procedures for preventing and correcting false alerts, and requesting comment on factors such as network distribution issues that might prevent delivery of WEA alerts and steps the commission should take to address inconsistent delivery. Okay, well, I'm glad I'm not working on this. My head would explode from all the bureaucratic things that have to happen. I realize great to have a system that warns people, you know, especially in case of, you know, tornadoes, tsunamis, very severe weather, or if a train derails and poison gas is floating around your neighborhood. Great to be alerted to that. So, seems like it takes a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of rules to try to make that happen in some kind of a standardized way. And then we're still subject to having mistakes made, like the one in Hawaii, where everybody was going to die in 15 minutes. So they apparently either weren't able to or chose not to rescind it or say, hey, folks, that was a false alarm for nearly an hour. So, it's a tough nut to crack, and I'm glad people are working on it. But wow. Chris, do you have any thoughts on the whole EAS thing, you know, either by cell phone, the WEA, or broadcast EAS? I mean, is there any simple solution, any marketplace-based solution?
I'm not sure if it's a simple solution, but sadly, I mean, I've had the opportunity to work a couple of times in Office of Emergency Management facilities in large cities and small counties, and I think what's happened is over the years, we've lost sight of the fact that, you know, any type of emergency management, right? It needs to have a certain protocol that has to be kept minimal. For some reason, everybody's got this thing that they have to have 27 pages of a procedure to do something. You know, let's take, for instance, the Hawaiian incident. I bet you there's probably 6 volumes of books that describe what you do, what the protocols are. And I think we've gotten away from ourselves from the basics, because we're so accustomed to playing with and relying on these devices that I have in my hand, which happens to be a smartphone, and the convenience that it creates. But the convenience actually circumvents the protection of a check in, check out, or opt in, opt out, or we'll say, verify whether or not what my statement is true or false. Take, for instance, the early days of EBS, right? The emergency broadcasting system, and you had the pink envelopes that were the authenticator mm-hmm. lists. Well, yeah. In New York City, when we had EBS during one of the administrations, we had a procedure where the mayor's office of emergency management, would deliver to us monthly a envelope, which would be the authentication words of the mayor's office. So that if something was activated, somebody tried to call in something and claim they're so-and-so, we had an envelope and a verification procedure that had to be followed. It was one sheet of paper, six steps. And I was part of the team that put it together. That's how I know it. And it worked. I mean, we never had a false alarm. We never had somebody try to spoof us. But when it came time to do a test dry run with the local agencies, NYPD, FDNY, EMS, and others, it was very simple procedure. It worked like it should. That's the kind of stuff I think we've lost sight of in some cases. Take, for instance, when you're watching a movie and it's a military type movie or say a submarine, and Crimson Tide. How's that? There's one. There's with Denzel Washington and Gene Hackman, right? Two sub commanders on a nuclear sub. The world theater is currently under siege of somebody with nuclear weapons possibly taking control, and an emergency alert message EAM comes across, but doesn't come across 100%. Now you don't know. You're cut off. What's going on? But there's checks and balances. And throughout the entire movie, they showed you can't do this without that. And, I can't fire a weapon without the key. Both keys have to be in the system. There's checks and balances to pause to make sure that you're verifying what's going on. And I think that's what we're missing in some cases, because I've watched many a time when I've gotten phone calls from local authorities about something. I'm like, okay, I'm not sure what you're hearing and where you heard that from, but I can tell you that I can verify right now that that's not right. I have a logging machine that logs our air signal, so I can tell you exactly what was on the air. Nope, nothing there. Never went to alert, never had to call anybody, didn't panic. But if you're a station that's automated and your EAS goes automatically through without intervention by local staff, then you're relying on the originator to make sure that they have verified what's going on. See how this can become a very crazy, vicious cycle, circle of chaos if we just assume, well, if we do this, 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 and this, and then this, and then that, we should be fine. Too many steps. Remember, the human brain can only do so much before it goes into panic mode.
So it seems that stations have, or our broadcast industry has said, you know what, since many of our stations are unmanned, especially after that incident where I think there was a train derailment or some kind of chemical gas problem in a smaller town in the Midwest, there was nobody at the radio station. Apparently, the authorities couldn't raise anybody there. And so then it was the broadcast industry kind of said, you know what, we're going to turn this over to the authorities. And if they want to take over our radio station, here's the equipment to do it, and we'll pass the message along. Of course, when that was designed, I'm not sure that we had thought as much or maybe enough about authentication. Sure, there's not much equipment that makes the tones. You can have a computer though do that. Although they've just gone to cryptographic signing, I suppose, of the cap based systems. That's why everybody had to update or is having to update their EAS boxes to look for a certificate along with the cap code. That doesn't protect the broadcast side of things, the over the air. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I wish it was easier, but it's a kind of tough thing to do. Well, let's move on, Chris. I want to mention that iHeart, who's been very active in podcasting and digital delivery, aside from all their over-the-air radio stations, they have created a new position called Vice President of Podcast Programming, a guy by the name of Matty Stout, S-T-A-U-D-T, Matty Stout. It's M-A-T-T-Y, Matty Stout. Is the new vice president of podcast programming. He reports to the senior VP of podcasting, Chris Peterson. And then I just think it's interesting that that iHeart is doing this. Obviously, podcasting is very important. I think public broadcasters started putting more effort into this, or put effort into this a long time ago, and commercial broadcasters are doing that as well. You're right there at a station, Chris, that does a lot of podcasting. What are your thoughts?
Yes, we do. We do a lot of podcasting, a lot of video casting too. Well, podcasting is just another means of reaching the audience or creating audience engagement. It's nothing. It shouldn't be treated like some, you know, wild and crazy. This is unbelievable. It's a panacea of programming. It's another means to do what we do. Radio has always been, and television is, a content. It's a storytelling machine, and we are the storytellers. How do we get to the audience? Right now, it's currently over radio waves, TV signals. Podcasts now permit us the ability to do it either in real time across the internet, if you will, or on demand. And now the on demand creates a sort of value added programming, a VAP, if you will. And that's something we should be looking at and thinking, wow, how else can I expand on what I have? And don't use the current models that we have for broadcast and apply it to podcasting, which is what happened 10 years ago when everybody said podcasting was going nowhere. And then all of a sudden, in the last 2 years, it's skyrocketed. I think that's the key. We keep forgetting that it's about telling a story, and you have to have content that's compelling, perishable, as I call it, something that people can't get anywhere else. Because I've had more arguments with folks about, you know, we do the music the best anybody can. It's like, really? Because, you know, when I go to my little device here, this smartphone I'm holding, I can do it better, and usually for better rates or free. So you can't use that. So if you're a music station or a music network or music company, and you're a local regional group of say 20 stations, and you're all music, you need to look beyond the songs. You need to do what Rick Scalara always said, and he said in his book Rockin' America, you got to put something between the songs that make people want to come back. The songs are just there as a buffer. And I can tell you, working for a radio station back in 1986, the program director programmed the station with that in mind. We were playing music from Louis Armstrong to Barbra Streisand to Bruce Springsteen in 1 hour easily. But what we did between was contesting, live broadcasts, community events. We did all kinds of crazy stuff by today's standards. If you will, people say it's impossible, you can't do it. It worked. 75 cents of every ad dollar came to us.
Yeah. Yeah. You are so, so right. Our ability to provide a music playlist for ourselves as consumers is so easy, either from a service or from, you know, your own owned material. And, you know, when I listen to the radio for music, I'm almost disappointed when another song starts up at the end of one. I'd like to hear some compelling content when the song ends. Okay, maybe it's a jingle and we'll go to the next song, or maybe it's a quick liner next song. But then I really do expect to hear something. I don't want to hear more than a couple songs in a row. And yes, you know, all these stations, you know, 10 songs in a row or 20 songs in a row or 55 minutes of the most commercial free music. And I'm spending some time with a friend of mine who has been a program director at radio stations for a long time. Now he runs an ad agency, it's Roger Gaither. A lot of folks know him, and Roger and I have been spending the last couple of days and the evening. We'll have dinner and talking about the excitement that radio used to have, and he feels it's coming back. He feels that a lot of broadcasters are realizing we've got to put some excitement back in here. We've got to go back to doing contests, fun contests. He said, now he also pointed out, let me tell you about some of the crazy contests we did. I'm not sure it'd be illegal to do them anymore, or safe, or if our insurance company would let us. But he said, we've got to figure out ways to involve listeners in our contest, even if it's only, and by the way, you know, he fully recognizes only, you're lucky to get 5% of your listeners to do anything to participate in a contest. Most people listen passively, but you get that 5% involved with contesting, and they talk to their friends and they talk to their friends. And of course the passive listeners still hear this on the air. It's part of the entertainment. So even if, you know, a very tiny percentage of your listeners are actually participating in the contesting, it still has a big impact on many, if not most, if not all, the rest of the people listening. They hear that people are having fun with the station. Now, not every format is for that. I would imagine WBGO is not the place you're going to, you know, join, have a contest to, you know, say, see who can sleep on top of the billboard longest and win a car. But, you know, stations don't seem to do that so much anymore, although Roger feels it's coming back. Your thoughts?
Well, that kind of promotion was always rooted in some other element that was the goal. You know, the sleeping on a billboard or in a car at a billboard or on the highway was part of maybe a charity, maybe part of, you know, an event, something else tied into it. It wasn't just for the sake of doing it. And I think that's part of what we're, your imagination's not being used. I mean, I just had a discussion recently with a marketing person, in a broadcast marketing person, who's telling me, well, you know, we do this at our events. And I said, oh, really? Because I've been to your event. I thought it was pretty lame. And she looks at me like, what? I said, yeah, I think it was pretty lame. And matter of fact, it was insulting. And she goes, wow. Well, I said, well, here, the event was, it happened to be a music event. It was a big outdoor park event. And they had a table, and the setup was interesting setup. They had all kinds of handouts, paper handouts, you name it. It was like 15 different things going on. And I said, you know, the average person coming to this event that may be a listener of your station and their format, I think it was a rock and roll format. I said, they're here for the event. They're here to listen to the group play. And you being at a table trying to, you know, sell them on who you are and what we're about and here, take these things with you, makes no sense. They're not interested. They're not going to carry little pieces of paper or booklets or whatever you had. I said, you should be looking at that opportunity to introduce them to you, and you hand them one thing, a key ring or something of useful purpose, maybe their phone, a phone sticker holder with your logo on it as a reminder. And then you tie it into something at the website so they can go back and check it out and find out that, oh, there are more things going on than just the music. And this person looked at me like, well, it, you know, that's not that easy because it costs. You have to verify, you have to research, understand what is, you know, these are things that work. I said, really? Because you also had a prize wheel on the table. And the audience that was at this event, and that prize wheel thing, I'm pretty sure that was going to become a Frisbee if you stayed there any longer. Again, these are things that are going on in radio right now that need to be addressed. And as engineers, you know, I have to tie this in. As engineers, we need to bring to the table skills that we have. Like, for instance, I've been working on, you know, for the last 3 years now, I'm shooting videos and helping editing videos for music stuff we're doing. And I never thought in my life I'd be doing video and transmitter studio maintenance and design and other things. But I've been able to bring to the table, hey, you know, if we did this, this would be pretty cool. And they're like, well, okay, let's try it. And it's working out really well because tomorrow night we'll be shooting video at a club in New York City at midnight, and it's going to be wild, and it's going to be a series. And, you know, 6 months ago, nobody would have even thought we were thinking of doing it. And we said, well, let's try it. Let's see what happens. And it's starting to make sense. That's perishable. That's something nobody else can get. And the music, and we did a video yesterday. We interviewed Nate Wood. He's a jazz performer. He does a lot of things, more than jazz. And during the interview, after he played a set, he's talking to the interviewer. And he's asking, so who influences you? What's your influence to your music? Your parents? His parents are accomplished musicians and music writers. He goes, nah, David Byrne, Talking Heads. That's what I listen. That's what I'm listening to. That's where I got the idea to do these things. This is how I'm doing stuff. You're not going to get that on the cover art of the CD of his music. You're not going to get that on the CD itself, but you're going to get that during the interview of the music you just did with him. And that's what radio stations who do music only should be doing. Not a webcam in the studio for the morning show and say, that's nice. You know, play a few things and press a horn and scream. That's not going to do squat. But if you had Taylor Swift in the studio and you're doing a serious interview and talking and she performs along with it, because that's what it's about. You're a performer, so why don't you show it? If you're a musician, plays an instrument, show them playing the instrument. I don't just want to hear a conversation. You know, if he's a damn good guitar player, I want to hear him string it all. I want to hear those strings go and then have a conversation about what made you do that? And that's what we used to do 30, 40, 50 years ago. Think about it. Even live TV was that way.
And, you know, I don't mean to paint such a broad brush and saying the broadcast industry doesn't do that anymore. Obviously, some stations still do. Some big city stations do. Yeah. And some small city stations do. It just doesn't seem as widespread as it used to be. And so I find the broadcast industry is, in terms of producing content, I find pockets of enthusiasm. Where it used to be very, it seems like enthusiasm was more widespread. Maybe I'm looking at the past with rose-colored glasses. I hope not. But the one point I want to make to bring this back around to our tech podcast, ours, whether we're talking about Maddie Stout with iHeart in charge of, you know, with a new position for podcasting, or whether we're talking about putting live performers on the air, doing more contesting, doing more remote broadcasts, it will fall upon engineers like us to give people the technical facilities to get that done and to make it hopefully easy enough where a disc jockey can go out, somebody who's not particularly technically inclined, and do something that sounds good. Or if it's a bigger production, make sure that the engineer is fully involved from the beginning. We're going to plan it from the get-go so that you're not hit, you know, 3 days before, oh, we're doing a live remote from the basement of a building 20 miles away. Can you get a signal out of there? So, you know, no matter which way it is, or both, engineers should, I think engineers should step up to the plate, make sure management and programming knows that, hey, I'm available to help make this go well. I'm interested in the success of the radio station. I want to see the sound good. I want to see it, you be able to do it on your terms so that the technicalities are not an impediment to your success in promoting, building, and making the radio station shine.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, in fact, I was going to mention earlier, we're doing it. I'm involved in a two-way right now, right? KCRW, great station on the West Coast, is interviewing a person here in our studios, and I'm just babysitting, if you will, the console and ISDN codec. We also have in the rack, and you see the little green light flashing just down here below, is an Opal, Comrex Opal, which we've been using, introduced and said, hey, this is something we should be considering because we have a lot of opportunities where people can't make it to the studio for a quality recording, so we could do it from there, wherever they are, home or the office, using their smartphone or a computer with a setup. And just last night, no, Monday night, we did an interview with a gentleman who is in Mongolia and is a fan of the station and wanted to tell us about how he met somebody, he's married, how the radio station influenced his life and what goes on. And the programming folks were like, hey, this would be a great person to talk to for fundraising. Mongolia! He's sitting in a hotel room using a smartphone, talking to us over the Opal. So I'll plug it. You know, it's WebRTC. Let's be honest. It's WebRTC under engine with this. And we could not have done that any other way. I mean, yes, you could have done the phone quality, but I'm not going to, you know, we're not going to do that because it's distracting for people. But that's the kind of thing that we as techies, engineers, whatever you want to call it, need to let the radio station non-engineering types know that, hey, this is an ability to create revenue streams or non-traditional revenue, whatever you want to call it, you know, NTR. And we need to be the ones that bring it to the table. Why? Because we have the time and understanding and the wherewithal to explain how to do it. Matter of fact, if you happen to come into the studio here and you needed to use the Opal, I put together a little document. Very straight, very straightforward. This gets you through. I don't have to be here. I've already pre-programmed certain things in the box so you can do it. Yeah. That's the kind of stuff we need to be doing so that the barrier to entry is becoming less and less. And, you know, you talk to the folks at Comrex, they've built the entire business for since 1961, the ability to lower the barrier to entry, and they've done it right. So, you know, that's what we have to do. We have to do the same thing internally. Hey, you know, you got a morning guy, an afternoon guy, a weekend person, whoever, even a news person in your sports department that would love to be able to do something from the local stadium but just can't because of X. Well, you know, I'm using right now. I can't show you. Let me try this. Let's have some fun here. Let's see what happens when I do that.
Okay.
You see that little black thing with a yellow dot, that little thing? That's what I'm using right now for this podcast. The talk. I'm plugged into the back of a Mac Mini. That's the Digigram Q mic. It allows me to plug a microphone and a pair of headphones and a line input, if I choose, into a smartphone or, as you can see, my Mac Mini. And I'm now up and running, and I've got this going. We're using vMix call to connect for the video. I'm using the Q mic for the audio stage so I can hear you and you can hear me. And we're up and running. Yep. In less than 5 minutes, I put this together to do the podcast while I have people working in the studio and I've got an ISDN connection going. Imagine you had a person on staff that could be at a location outside the building participating in a show or a tape delay, and they can do the same thing very easily. They're not intimidated. Now, all of a sudden, you've got content you didn't have before. Just thinking. Wow. Just saying.
Yeah. That's that. And by the way, how does that Digigram little box connect to a cell phone? What's the interface?
It's a USB TRRS. It's an analog. Okay, so analog. Right through the audio. Gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha. So if you have a newer phone, you could use the Lightning adapter. But it works great. It's not meant to be the, you know, solution to everything, but it works. It has a gain control for the microphone, so you can actually raise the gain, lower the gain. I shouldn't do that. But yeah, that's where I use it. I've used it on several occasions with our tour.
Speaking of Lightning adapter, a little quick hint here. If you have it, I'm going to ask a question. If you know the answer, it'll be a hint. It'll be a tip. If not, well, then we'll have to find out. For iPhones that don't have a headphone jack, so what's it, the iPhone 7 and the iPhone 8 and the iPhone X, if you get the little Lightning to analog TRRS adapter where you plug your headphone in, that's got a mic in the line. If you use the Apple one of those adapters, again, Lightning to TRRS female, does the mic part work? Is it just headphone out? Do you know?
It should be a headphone and microphone, because in that little adapter is a DAC, a digital audio conversion. Yeah. It should be both, as far as my understanding.
So, because I've tried, I tried an off-brand one, and it was output only. The there was no, apparently no electronics or path, or it didn't work for mic in to an iPhone that just had the Lightning adapter. But it was an off-brand.
Yeah.
So guess I because that little cord right there is going to be very helpful. You should have, you know, have them in your kit, because there are plenty of products on the market that end up in a TRRS plug, and you want to go into a cell phone, which is fine, unless you have an iPhone 7 or 8 or X, which a lot of program directors and disc jockeys do. So, you know, you gotta have the right connections. Hey, Chris, one more quick item before we hear from our friends at Lavo. And actually, it's an item from our friends at Lavo. Just a quick news item, because they are a sponsor. Lavo has appointed Jeff Smith to head up sales in the Americas. He's a veteran of Evert's company. And so he's got a lot of background in television. And so if you're in the television market or a radio broadcaster that's moving in the television, you may very well end up talking with Jeff Smith with Lavo while you're, you know, when you're dealing with them. And speaking of Lavo, let's have a quick look at the Ruby console.
There has probably never been a better time in history to buy a new radio mixing console. Today's consoles are more sophisticated than ever, with more features and functions than you can shake a stick at. But have you noticed how complicated they are? There's a sea of knobs and switches and displays and buttons. Some of them look like you might need a pilot's license to do your show. Well, a board doesn't have to be complicated to be powerful. Just look at the new Ruby mixing surface from Lavo. The first thing you notice is how smooth and streamlined it is. Ruby has lots of cool tech, but what it doesn't have is that confusing ocean of buttons that clutter things up. Now, we all know that there are some console features the jock only uses once in a while, so why dedicate controls to them? Ruby fixes this problem by moving those once-in-a-blue-moon controls to a touch-sensitive, customizable GUI that happily shares screen space with your other studio software, helping you fight control room clutter. Thanks to this design innovation, talent that use Ruby produce smoother shows with less errors. Controls that are used the most fall naturally to hand, while functions that rarely need adjustment are easily controlled with just a couple of clicks in the context-sensitive GUI. And Ruby has cool features you won't find on other boards, like Auto Mix, an intelligent gain writing function that guarantees the perfect mix for multi-mic morning shows and call-in segments. Dual mode snapshots that instantly switch the motorized faders between on-air and production modes, and enough DSP and I/O options to make even your pro sound pals green with envy. And because quality is as important to Lavo as it is to you, every console is proudly built to fanatically precise standards at Lavo's own factory in Germany. If you're ready to declutter your control room, do yourself a favor. Check out the new Ruby and the other cool Lavo radio tech at www.lavo.com/twert.
And thanks a lot to Lavo for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. Appreciate that. It's episode number 401 with Kirk Harnack and Chris Tobin. It's just us today, and we are talking about what's in the headlines right now. And something else that's in the headlines that caught my eye was, you know, we've heard a little bit about needing to register your C-band receive dish. And if you're a network affiliate, Premier, Westwood One, any of those and lots of others, you are – you have a C-band dish. You probably know if you do, it's a big dish. You probably had to re-aim it back a couple of years ago. Well, the WBU, that's the World Broadcasting Union, they're calling for C-band protection. And I'm reading into this, they're calling for blanket protection. In other words, they don't want at all for the FCC to set up a shared spectrum or a geographically fenced area for use, reuse of the C-band spectrum in the upper part of that spectrum. So, Chris, you know, we've been encouraged to register our satellite dishes. Do you know of stations doing this? Has everybody you know in the New York area already done this?
Best of my knowledge, a lot of folks here in the New York area have done it. A lot of folks probably haven't. I'm of the opinion we should not have to pay the commission to register the links. And I think that's creating a barrier to folks that are not doing it because, hey, just they can't see the value and they may just decide I'll find my program some other means because I just can't afford it. Then the other half is I still don't believe, and I unfortunately, I I have a bias against the cellular or mobile industry because of this attitude of they have the need. It's an imperative. It's a human right. You know, it's like this whole this BS. Broadcasters have used the C-band for distribution. Broadcast, when I say that, I mean radio, television, cable, others. There's other people in there. It's not just those three. It's a known entity. It's known how it works. It's a one-to-many. And there was a comment in one of the FCC responses I read just yesterday, I think it was, where they made a comment that only, you know, only 1,000 responses have been shown, or there's only 1,000. You know, obviously, there's plenty of room to work with. It's like, well, no, that's not how it works, though. It's a little satellite, you know, 26,000 miles away, right, 26, beaming down to a geographic area that may be populated in one part, it may not be in another, but it's there for use and for growth. That's how it works. This mindset that we have to have everything working and filled and the spectrum has to be doing stuff makes no sense. And by the way, the mobile industry, there's plenty of spectrum you already have. Didn't AT&T just give back several billion dollars worth because they couldn't find a use for it? Or was it Sprint? Or was it T-Mobile? I'm not sure which one. Oh, no, T-Mobile's trying to stay in business because Sprint can't stay in business, so they're going to try and buy them. Really? I mean, think about it. There's a lot of spectrum out there that's not being properly managed, and cell sites are the same way. And it's just, I think it's a time now broadcasters, NAB, needs to force the hand. I'm glad to see that the World Broadcasting Unions have decided to say something, because I think it's wrong. This is the way the system works. It's one to many. Yeah. End of story. Just because in Sullivan County, New York, Oneonta, New York, there's only six stations grabbing a signal off SATCOM C5. I'll just use an old term. It doesn't mean that it's not valid. It doesn't mean it's outdated. That's just the way it is. Yet New York City has 2,700 maybe. I mean, you know, 200 downlinks taking place from that same satellite that's also serving Oneonta, New York, or Albany, or Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. So how do you claim that somewhere in the middle – oh, look, there's a little geographic triangle in between Philly, Harrisburg, and Reading. We could stick in, you know, these terrestrial links for 5G because God knows we need it. Really? Think about it. I mean, it's getting annoying. You know, you could do a lot with 10 megahertz, 10 megabits up and down, believe it or not.
You know, I'm a little I'm annoyed too at the fact that that you would have to register a receive link. The transmitter has already been licensed. And it already has a coverage area. And that coverage area, I realize part of it's just a law of physics. It's a large coverage area, larger than maybe it absolutely has to be. But we know there are stations on the fringes of coverage areas that have to buy bigger dishes. And what if instead of counting the number of receive sites and saying FCC, we have 2,800 receive sites or whatever it may be. What if instead we counted the number of listeners that were being served from those receive sites? Well, FCC, it turns out that 127 million people every week are served by the C-band downlinks. You know, I mean, it's not like one person with one radio or one guy with a satellite dish in his backyard who wants to watch HBO like we used to do back in the 80s. This is part of an infrastructure. And the transmitter is licensed to cover an area. And there are, you know, spot beams and formed beams. I mean, look at the coverage area from the satellite that broadcasters use. I forget the name of it right now. You know, the one we had to just move to. It's not a hemispherical coverage. It covers, you know, the places very well, very defined area. I just think that the transmitter and its coverage area should be licensed and protected. And I thought it was. Why should people with receiving antennas, you know, have to register them to avoid interference? And my stations, we've got several different locations in Mississippi where we have C-band dishes. We honestly can't afford to be filing with the FCC for each of these locations. If we did file, we'd file probably just for one and hope it, you know, helped out that area. So I agree with you. Yeah. I agree with you. I think it's a kind of ridiculous idea to share this particular spectrum. But you know what?
Well, yeah,
I don't know. I mean, anybody who's asked to share a spectrum may think that, no matter what they do. You know, I get it.
Well, listen, sharing spectrum has been done a long time. And in some places, in some cases, it can be done. Take, for instance, the BAS frequencies, the 2 gig and 7 gig that broadcasters use for microwave links for remote broadcasts. They were forced to give up several megahertz worth of it and have to coexist. Boy, did they discover that there's a few issues with that. But that's not the same because it's point to point. It's already local, geographic. It's something you can work out. But nobody paid attention. They said, oh, we're just going to do it. Really? It just can't be that way. You cannot say, give the excuse, well, in order for life to go on, society to survive, 5G has to be provided for. Really? Go pound sand, because I only have one choice when I want to get my 4G services. And it's annoying. Or I have two choices. And that's it. And I just watched the other day on a New York City public access channel, the New York City Council on Franchising for Cable Systems, license renewals coming up, franchise license renewal. Interestingly enough, several people before the council were making a case and said, we like the council of the city to open up franchising to other than just one cable service. I'm not going to say the name. And they asked, well, why? Well, because we're a assisted living home organization. We have several places, and the cost of cable is exorbitant. It's over $200 a month, and it doesn't make any sense for what we want to do. We can't shop around for anybody else because there is no one else to go to. And why is that? Oh, right, because the municipalities tried to do that 10 years ago, and Verizon, AT&T sued them and made some claim, and I guess the local people courts believed it. What claim could you make? They said they could put us out of business. It was unfair competition. Really? What's unfair about the city of Philadelphia? That's where the case started. The city of New York, San Francisco, LA, providing limited broadband services to their residents who are paying taxes for municipal services. Hello? And what about that universal fee that every phone company gets that's supposed to help build out the remote locations of the country where broadband and communications is difficult to do. Mm-hmm. That's a $10 billion bucket that nobody seems to be talking about. But yet we're going to give up satellite space because that 5G we need to be able to do those local links to improve services. Oh, and what about the Wi-Fi offloading? What's it called? WLA? LAF, where they use the Wi-Fi frequencies to offload cellular, and they can take control. So this way, there's a name for it. I can't think of it now. I was just reading about it this weekend. There's another thing. It's like, hello? It's getting ridiculous. I know I'm ranting. I know it's like, this is crazy, whatever you want to call it. But the reality is it's technology. It's technical. It's not it's very straightforward. Cell sites can be beamforming. You can come up with ways to make things work. More spectrum could be used. Matter of fact, what's his name? Cooper, the guy who developed, was part of the team that developed that thing we now use. What's this thing again? Oh, yeah, the smartphone, or what's known as cellular technology, from Motorola, said it himself. He says, look, there's a lot of waste going on in the industry. Nobody's paying attention. There's ways to maximize what's currently in use. Nobody's doing it. And then you have to have situations where T-Mobile and Sprint are vying for buying each other out. And now the reason is, well, Sprint doesn't think they can survive and they need to be bought out in order to be survived. Oh, they have to buy T-Mobile in order to survive. You know what I say to that? Well, such is luck. You don't make business. You can't make it happen. Somebody else will fill your shoes. Remember the Etzel? I mean, come on. that's a poor excuse. Matter of fact, it was the same excuse AT&T and T-Mobile used several years ago to make their merger happen, which didn't happen. But conveniently, everybody made money on that deal when they didn't make it happen because it was a clause. Oh, yeah, if you don't buy us, because of the inconvenience, you have to pay several billion dollars. And the banks got what they wanted, and so did all the attorneys involved and everybody else. Everybody got what they wanted. So I'm sorry. I am emphatically C-band, leave it alone. I shouldn't have to pay to prove that I'm using it because that's not the way it should work. And you're right. The transmitter's a license. The transmitter has a footprint. Done. End of story. It's just like if I have a microwave I have a TV station. I'm transmitting to a metro area. Well, you know what? There are parts of the metro area that have dead spots. I can put something in there and get 5G if I do it. So what do I do? You, the consumer, you're the TV owner, you need to send me a form for $200 to tell me that you're using that signal so that we can verify that geographical dead spot isn't actually dead indeed. I know it sounds like crazy, but think of that statement. Think of what I just gave an example. It's no different than I'm using the NPR satellite downlink to get our programming, but I can tell you 6 miles away is a dead spot. There's nobody there receiving anything. You could easily put something in, but who's to say that link that they put in at C-band doesn't spill over to me because of, what's that called again?
Right.
Oh yeah. Radio propagation.
Radio. Yeah. Radio waves don't respect fences or boundaries very well at all. Do they?
Exactly.
They do respect Faraday cages. Faraday did discover a way to hold them in, but we can't live in a world full of Faraday cages. We kind of do in a way, but anyway. Hey, no, I love it when you get on a rant. That's great. Makes the show extra good. Hey, I got one more quick topic before we hear from something else, and that is the Alabama Broadcasters Association. They are hosting a free ABIP, that's Alternative Broadcast Inspection Program, seminar. Now, that's the program where if you're a radio station owner, you can say, hey, I want to pay, typically it's your state broadcast association. I want to pay for a kind of like a mock inspection. I want to pay for an inspection from an ABIP, Alternative Broadcast Inspector. And if you do that and fill out the form, tell the FCC that you've done this and passed it, then you kind of have a, unless you get some specific complaints, the FCC won't surprise inspect you for some period of time. I think it's 3 years. But so this is a way that broadcast owners can find out, hey, is there something we're overlooking here in terms of safety or compliance, either technical compliance or paperwork compliance? And so anyway, there's a free seminar. The Alabama Broadcast Association, I believe, has done this before. Their director, Larry Wilkins, he's in charge of the Engineering Academy at the ABA. He said that it's a two-day program, two-day seminar. It's open to engineers from any state. You don't have to be in Alabama. And it doesn't matter if you previously have trained to be an ABIP inspector. Wilkins says the program could be helpful to as an educational tool to aid engineers in maintaining their own operations, whether or not you become an ABIP inspector, but it will help you definitely keep current and legal with the FCC rules and regulations. The seminar is taught by, a lot of us know this guy, South Carolina ABIP inspector John George. A lot of us know John George, in addition to Wilkins, who also serves as the ABIP inspector for Alabama. Wilson notes that the commission had expressed an interest in making sure that ABIP inspectors across the U.S. are on the same page, as you know they'd want to do, and he believes that the seminar is definitely a step in the right direction. Now, here's when it is. It's this month. Oh, I'm sorry. It's July. It's coming up next month, July 17th and 18th, to be held in a classroom setting at the ABA Training Center, followed the next day by mock inspections at local broadcast stations. So there's a link to register online. You can go to, I'm sure you can go to the ABA's website too. I'll put a link for that in the show notes. It is okay. Here's the ABA's website, is AL as in Alabama, AL-BA.com. Now that's for the broadcast engineering, the Broadcasting Engineering Academy. So al-ba.com, and you can go from there to find information on this seminar. All right, ABIP. Chris, you guys have an ABIP inspector in New York where you live. Yes, I think you do.
Yeah, we do. Actually, there's a couple. I'm trying to remember who they are now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we have a couple. Oh. Why? Yeah.
I thought one of the ABIP inspectors in New York was our friend and former regular co-host.
Tom Ray. Yes, I was gonna say that.
I thought so. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a good program. It makes sense. It helps you to, you know, check and see what you've got and what you don't have, or your interpretation of maybe the rules and what they should be or shouldn't. I've been on a couple of them. When I was working with the folks at CBS, we used to do our own internal ones, and we had somebody come from outside to verify what we did. And it made sense. It worked, and it was handy. And it's a good thing. It keeps you on your toes. Makes sense.
Well, I'll put a link for that in the show notes. Hey, coming up in just a minute, we got news for you. Somebody is going to install 35 FM transmitters. Somebody is.
Nice.
They got a big job ahead of them. It's actually like a whole bunch of somebody's. Well, we'll have details on that coming up, and we'll hit a couple final headlines as well, like Kiev, Ukraine, getting 9 or 10 digital radio stations. So good for them. I think that's going to be more the wave of the future here. So we're coming back in just a minute. Let's hear a moment from our friends at Innovonics about an amazing product that a lot of folks need right now. Check it out.
The Aran 655 is the latest addition to the Innovonics family of rebroadcast receivers. Designed specifically for FM broadcast translators, also referred to as relay transmitters. The Aran 655 is unique as an uncompromising DSP-based HD radio and FM receiver combined with a powerful 3-band audio processor and dynamic RDS encoder. IP connectivity adds streaming capabilities, and a web browser interface gives you total remote control of the unit from any PC or mobile device. The Aran 655 gives you maximum flexibility for program sources. select program audio from analog FM, digital channels HD 1 through 8, streaming sources, and analog or AES digital line inputs, all with assignable failover audio backup. The internal RDS encoder allows you to customize your RDS messaging. You can use incoming off-air RDS data, convert HD radio pad data to RDS, convert streamed metadata to RDS, or receive IP telnet data. Comprehensive audio processing includes gated and windowed AGC, a unique syllabic leveler, three bands of compression, and both wideband and independent HF limiting. Easy setup is achieved by using 10 factory presets and 10 customizable presets. The processor also supports dayparting, allowing automatic preset changes to follow different programming formats throughout your broadcast day. The front panel has an OLED display and jog wheel with intuitive menus for easy setup, advanced control, and editing for all operating parameters. The Aran 655 dynamic web interface gives you total remote control of the unit from any PC or mobile device. A comprehensive set of menus includes a quick overview of now playing info, input-output control, processor options, RDS encoder, alarms and notifications, SNMP settings, and much more. You can also listen to the live audio broadcast streamed through the web interface. On the back of the Aran 655, you've got an antenna input, left and right analog inputs and outputs, AES digital input and output, MPX output for the rebroadcast transmitter, and a network port for the IP interface. There's also a terminal block with a series of connections to interface with remote control management equipment. The Aran 655 is compatible with worldwide radio broadcast standards and operates on 90 to 230 volts AC. It comes complete with a printed installation user guide to get you up and running quickly and provide in-depth knowledge of the product. Like all Inovonics products, it is backed by a 3-year factory warranty and premier after-sales service. Contact your Inovonics dealer for more information.
Yes, Kurt needs a mute light. Hey, you're muted. Thanks to Broadcaster General Store. Yes, thanks to Broadcaster's General Store for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. And thanks to Inovonics for being a co-sponsor along with Broadcaster General Store. You can reach out to Broadcaster General Store easily 24 hours a day at their website, bgs.cc. bgs.cc. You can call them too. They're great on the phones. Love these folks. The phone number is 352-622-7700. They're in the Eastern Time Zone in Ocala, Florida. Lovely Ocala. Again, that number is 352-622-7700. I keep that at my fingertips really easy. Actually, it's probably in here by now. I've been ordering from them for many decades now. Thanks a lot again, Broadcast General Store. All right, Chris, let's wrap things up with this 35 transmitters. And these were, let me get to the story here. The story is Cumulus. Cumulus ordered 35 more FM transmitters. They are Gates Air Flexivas. They're air-cooled. They're being ordered for a variety of reasons, and they're mostly in the 10 to 40 kilowatt range. So, you know, these are all, you know, full stand-up big transmitters requiring, you know, plumbing and power and all that. So this will be an installation job for a number of engineers. Although I think, you know, the people like to do this. I like to put a new transmitter in, even though it's a lot of work. You break a sweat typically. You got to be careful. You got to, you know, do things. If there's, you know, electrical codes to comply with, you need to be careful of those and do your plumbing correctly. And then you got all your remote control to hook up. Although SNMP can make that a whole lot easier. They're putting these in places like Youngstown, Ohio, where they've had a lot of heating and cooling issues. That's going to help solve those. In the Atlanta market, Cumulus is building out an auxiliary facility, a backup facility, for three of their big FMs. And those stations are being affected by the TV repack. So they have to broadcast from somewhere else for a while during the tower and antenna work at their main site. So gotta be prepared for that. Cumulus VP of Engineering Yancey McNair said that our daily operations have benefited from this transmitter, the Gates Air Flexivas modular design, hot swappable power modules, and dual power supplies. So good for them. Chris, you like installing new transmitters?
Of course, I always do. It's always fun. It's easier today, you know, nowadays. I mean, I was doing it back in the day. I sound like an old, you know, fart, but back in the day when you had vacuum tubes and electrical efficiencies and everything else you had to worry about. It was a lot of fun, and it was challenging at times. But now you fast forward to today, solid state transmitters, with broadband outputs and everything about it. As you pointed out, SNMP makes it plug and play. I mean, I've installed a couple of transmitters over the years that I think we did it in 8 hours, a complete installation, plumbing, RF plumbing, that is, and remote control and everything else. And that's it, done. Whereas tube transmitter and other things back in the early days before SNMP, you could easily take a weekend and then still hope that at Sunday night at 11 p.m. you're flipping that plate switch on and everything comes up like it should.
It seems that older transmitters were bigger. It used to be a 20 kilowatt transmitter was three cabinets and maybe an outboard power supply. I certainly had a 27 kilowatt transmitter that was three cabinets and a big honking outboard supply. And you had to plan for, big honking forklifts. Now, new transmitters, still have big power supplies. They're solid state, so the voltages are much lower, but the currents are much higher. Typically, you don't have 15, 20,000 volts for a plate voltage in these things, but you do have several hundred amps of current feeding all the MOSFET output transistors. So that's something to be dealt with. But overall, yeah, I agree with you. I think they're easier.
They're easier, let me just say they're easier. Yeah. Yes, it has a lot of new advantages, but they are still dangerous. You still require proper safety procedures. Step by step, do not assume just because, as you point out, Kirk, it's a low voltage, you're okay. 5 volts at 30 amps can hurt. 5 volts at 400 amps can hurt. Okay.
Yeah.
Just remember the math, Ohm's law, Kirchhoff's law, both apply. Trust me, you'll find out real fast and you don't want to do that. But it is easier. Yes, it's much easier to do. But if you're not an RF person or understand transmitters, and you're an IT guy at the station with responsibility for some transmitter stuff, do not assume you can do it yourself. Reach out to people in your market. I say this because I've gotten calls from people who are in a panic and like, I don't know what to do. I'm like, who are you and what do you do for a living? Oh, yeah, this is not a Dell server. Absolutely. You got a problem there.
This, although a lot of them are looking more like a cabinet with Dell servers in them.
That's fine.
You bring up a great point about the low voltage, high current. It's even more critical that connections be super, super tight and good and clean when you have hundreds of amps of electricity running through them. I mean, if you had 8 amps or 4 amps running through at 15,000 volts, if that connection wasn't real tight, either it would let you know or it would just sit there and make itself tighter. Just the nature of high voltage. But a low voltage, high current, all that connection is going to do is get hot if you haven't made sure it's tight. And in shipping, and when you unpack a transmitter, I'm sure the manual says so, but you certainly should go through the transmitter and check every big connection to make sure that whatever's holding it, whether it's a bolt or a stud, whatever clamp it is good and tight, because that's going to be a problem. If there's heat there, it's going to build up and make the connection worse, and pretty soon you're going to have a fire or melted metal right there.
All the rules are still apply for transmitter maintenance, whether it's the new solid state or tubes. Check the fans, check your filters, make sure the airflow is proper. Please, with solid state transmitters today and the amount of current and temperature, the heat that comes out of them, they're not as tolerant as a tube transmitter. Make sure the airflow is proper in and out. Create the circle, supply demand. That's how it works. Supply return, I guess I should say, for HC terminologies. Make sure you've got it right. I'll say that Nortel has a good webinar and talks about why you shouldn't do things a certain way, where the air conditioning duct should be or the return duct, the plenum return, depending on the room you build. I think Gates Air also has some stuff. Yeah, they do. They have some of their periodicals have that too. Very important. The life of your transmitter could be extended considerably if you make sure it's properly operating at temperature. And it's easy to forget that because they're very quiet, And if you have is it Flexiva? Yeah, I think it's a Flexiva. So it's a water cooled transmitter. So don't be fooled by the quietness. You still need to make sure that the water cool process is proper. The balance is where it should be. The heat exchanger is where it's working because you're still drawing heat away from the box. You're just doing it with water or glycol type. I shouldn't say glycol 100%. No, wait. Is glycol still legal? I think it is. But a glycol type mix. And so you still have to maintain the balance and understand what is going on. So just, don't don't get lax. Trust me, it'll hurt. The laws of physics can be tempted, taunted with, but boy, when you try to twist them out of shape, they will come back and hurt. Okay, so just don't go there.
You mentioned that water-cooled transmitter, and that will be the topic of some upcoming TORT episode. Our friend Charles Kinney in Atlanta, Georgia, has installed one of these. I want to say it's a 40-kilowatt water-cooled Flexiva transmitter, and he is delighted with it. He said, come on down and let's do a little video story about it. I'll be glad to come on TORT and tell your audience all about, how that's different than an air-cooled transmitter, which is what, I've only ever used. So that'll be a good show coming up. Hopefully sometime this summer or certainly by this fall, we'll be able to get down and see Charles Kinney for that show. Hey, Chris, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just saying, there's a World Trade Center site that I go to is all water-cooled transmitter with the exception of one or two of them. And it's dead quiet. It's scary because when you look at the amount of power that's going through the RF plumbing and you look at like, wow, I could actually have a conversation with you in a whisper and this is a 90,000 watt TV transmitter. Wow. I remember the days of Klystrons. You had to wear David Clark headsets in order to talk to somebody in front of those things.
Well, you remember, and we did one of our TORT shows about this, the little seminar that we had about putting the antenna on the roof of the building at the new, what's it called? I'm sorry. The new World Trade Center, the new building?
Yeah, One World Trade. Yeah. Liberty Tower, but it's known as One World Trade.
And so we're sitting in the seminar room listening to John Lyons make a presentation about this. And what was the loudest thing in the room? It was a server. A single server. Yes. That was part of a television broadcast setup. It was in a proper rack with a cage, and it couldn't be turned off. But it was the loudest thing in the room, and the transmitters were relatively quiet. We could have had a very easy time hearing if it wasn't for that one server.
Yeah, and don't forget, you're talking, there were eight cabinets of transmitters there. Eight cabinets of transmitters that were quiet, and one computer server was making the noise that was actually above the ambient sound of a transmitter. That in itself is just like, wow, I never thought I'd live long enough to see that.
Exactly. Hey, we're going to have to go. Chris, it's enjoyable just to be able to shoot the breeze and talk about a few topics that are top of mind or top of the headlines. By the way, the topics for today's show and some of the information has come out of the pages of Radio World magazine. And you can go to radioworld.com and stay informed. Be sure you sign up for their newsletter. I'm giving them a free plug because I really like the folks at Radio World. They really do a good job to keep up with the broadcast business. Thanks to them for providing us some fodder to talk about. I should have prefaced some of the stories with Radio World reports because it wasn't me reporting. I was taking that information from Radio World, but good to catch up on it and hear your thoughts on it, Chris. We're going to go. Chris, any parting thoughts before we have to run?
No. For those of you in the hemisphere that has summertime temperatures coming your way, enjoy them, barbecue, and make sure you have some fun and don't spend every day 12 hours at work. Put some aside for some fun because it'll help you think more in your imagination in order to bring more ideas and revenue generating concepts to your office so you can keep your job.
Yes. Revenue generating concepts are always good, even for engineers, especially for engineers. We're going to go. Thanks a lot to our producer, Suncast, for producing This Week in Radio Tech. Thanks to Chris Tobin for being here as well. And to our sponsors, the Telos Alliance and the Telos Infinity IP Intercom System, an amazing product. Also the folks at Lavo and their Ruby console and Inovonics with their Aaron 655 receiver, rebroadcast receiver. Quite an amazing box at Broadcasters General Store. And we're going to see you next week. We have another engineer coming on as our guest next week. If it's the guy I'm thinking of, I should check the calendar. It's going to be an interesting show. He is at some amazing transmitter sites and will certainly have some tales to tell and some good advice as well. So tell your friends and neighbors about This Week in Radio Tech, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.